Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Smart Family Podcast. I am your co-host, Dr. Rob Meter. And as many of you know, I'm a mental health pediatrician, and we love to focus on issues that will educate parents on topics related to the mental health of their children. Now, I talk a lot in my practice about the three no-brainers of mental health: sleep, diet, and exercise, and the importance of those. And we've been wanting to do an episode on exercise for a while now. So while no one would debate the usefulness of exercise, I think a lot of parents are wondering about, should I put my kids into sports? So I've got four kids myself, and I tell you, it's a good question. A lot of us are coming out of COVID and sports are starting up again, and so many of you are reevaluating your priorities, and perhaps signing your kids back up for soccer or hockey or gymnastics is on your list or not. Or maybe you're a new parent and you've got a toddler who loves to run around. You've seen some natural talent emerging and are thinking, I should sign him up for ... Or maybe you love biking or dance or lacrosse as a kid and you want your child to experience that same joy and develop to their maximum potential. But recent stories in the news have concerned you, stories about toxic cultures in sports, shaming cultures, the negative impacts sports can have on mental health, etc. Well, I think there are few people who would argue against the benefits of exercise, but on today's show, I want to unpack the idea of sports. And the last example I raise, especially, is the sports environment toxic for kids and teenagers? Does it need to be? What do parents need to know? Why do we see so much bullying, not just in sports, but in our society in general, and what can we do about it? So I was really excited to be introduced to today's guest. Her name is Jennifer Fraser. Jennifer is not just an incredible teacher. She is also an amazing researcher who has had her own very real lived experience with bullying, not just in sports, but in all facets of society. Jennifer wants to abolish the idea that being tough on young people improves performance. She has written extensively about this topic, and her latest book, The Bullied Brain, Heal Your Scars and Restore Your Health, was an incredible read. I highly recommend it. The book tackles the topic of trauma, which we've tackled before on the podcast, but puts it in really a whole new spotlight. Jennifer is a best-selling author, and she is an award-winning educator. She has a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Toronto. She teaches online courses as well, which provide dynamic lessons in the impact neuroscience has on personal development and culture change. Her previous book, which is called Teaching Bullies, Zero Tolerance on the Court and or in the Classroom, explores what happens when a bully is a teacher or a coach. And her new book, which has just been released, is called The Bullied Brain, Heal Your Scars and Restore Your Health. And it delves into how bullying affects the brain and how the brain can heal. I think you're going to love our conversation. Here is Jennifer Fraser. Jennifer Fraser, welcome to the Smart Family Podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob Meter. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yeah, so I'm in north of Toronto. Where are you joining us from today?
I am on Vancouver Island. I live in the capital of British Columbia, Victoria, BC.
Awesome. Okay, great. Well, Jennifer, I heard about your recent book, The Bullied Brain. We're going to talk a bit more about that for sure. And I'd wanted to do an episode here about sports, and really wanted to figure out, like, how do we get kids more involved in sports? I mean, ultimately, that's what I was trying that's the message I wanted to convey, because as a mental health pediatrician, I'm always telling kids, you know, get involved in exercise, you know, sports is such a great way to do that. But even before COVID hit, we kind of saw sports drop off a little bit. We saw participation in organized sports drop off. And there was a couple of reasons, I think, for that. You know, parents were maybe afraid of injuries and concussions. There was a cost associated to it. There was a significant time commitment, et cetera. But in your book, you really cover another reason. And in fact, you bring to light a startling statistic that 70% of kids will drop out of sports at the age of 13. And I would love for you to begin by telling us why that is?
I had a book come out in 2015 called Teaching Bullies. And in all honesty, and I can tell someone like yourself who's an expert, I wrote that book in a state of post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay. So I was very much a frantic and distraught mother whose son had been abused among with other student athletes in a coaching situation. And so I'm a researcher by trade. I've got a PhD in comparative literature. We were trained that you really don't have an opinion, and your opinion is not what people need from you as an academic. Your job is to do the research. So when I had all the people in my world telling me that bullying and abuse weren't a really big deal and, you know, just toughens kids up for a tough world and it's just old school coaching, I kept thinking to myself, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sit right with me. What does the research say? So I did a deep dive into the research for teaching bullies. I looked at the law. I looked at education. I looked at coaching. I looked at abuse and bullying and psychiatry and mental health. And then I hit the neuroscience. And when I hit the neuroscience, I was like, oh my heavens, I don't know anything about the brain. How is that possible? You know, I'm in my late 40s and I haven't taught myself about the brain. I'm in the business of education. That is a brain-driven industry. Why don't I know more? So I started to learn more and more about it. So in 2016, the National Alliance of Youth Sports in the States, they had done a poll. And this is where they got the statistic. And it was written up in the Washington Post, this really, as you say, shocking and startling statistic that 70% of our kids are dropping sports at 13. So for me, that was the moment where I said to myself, well, that's just at the start of adolescence. What's going on in a 13-year-old's brain? Well, it's a time of intense development, which again, I hadn't learned about until I did it myself. I read all this stuff about the adolescent brain. And from 13 to 25, as you would know, but many don't, the adolescent brain is not mature. It's not grown up. So these kids look like adults, but on the inside, inside their skulls, they are very much undergoing intensive neuroplastic development. And it makes them extremely sensitive and extremely vulnerable to any form of bullying and abuse practices. So the fastest way to drive a kid out of sports is to humiliate them or to make them look embarrassed or stupid or shamed in front of their peers. Well, in the adult world, that type of behaviors become very normalized and very normalized in sports. So we have this kind of perfect storm of incredibly sensitized, amazingly risk-taking, creative, problem-solving, very high levels of learning, peer-sensitive, peer-driven brains, the adolescent brain, and it's coming up against an adult who thinks their job is to humiliate and toughen them up and drive them into some kind of state where they perform better. And so this is really where National Alliance of Youth Sports, they asked me to come down to Florida and present to the, it was about 300 people, mostly men, who are the heads of recreation and sport organizations in the US. And they kept saying to me, the National Alliance kept saying, don't talk about neuroscience, whatever you do, that these guys don't want to know the science, which was hilarious. And yeah. So I convinced them that I could be very straightforward about it. So I started off the talk by saying, okay, you know, raise your hand if you can name five parts of the body and, you know, think sports, what's it involved in? Well, every hand in the room went up, 300 guys. Then I said, well, raise your hand if you can tell me, you know, essentially five parts of the brain. We're not supposed to divide it up that way, but, you know, for the sake of this game we're having, five parts of the brain and what its essential involvement is. And literally there was maybe three hands out of 300 that went up. And I said, okay, let's start there. How come we don't know more about our brains?
Yeah, no, I think it's such an important point because even like sports psychology has really recognized that, you know, how the state of your brain is so important in performance in sports. And yet here we are recognizing that kids are going into sports where their brain is really being abused. And so thanks for uncovering that. And thanks for shining a spotlight on that, because I can see why, you know, kids would not be interested at all in signing up for that.
No, it's almost as if they recognize that there's something very wrong. There's something unhealthy. It doesn't feel good. So on the National Alliance Youth Sports poll, kids reported. So imagine their language that they use. They said they don't want to play sports anymore and they drop out at 13 because it's not fun. Well, match that up against this world of adults who are driving kids and making them perform and saying they have to go against what their body's telling them and pushing them against their friends and dividing the team. You know, there's the favorites and then there's the targets of bullying, and they're using toxic masculinity like we see in some of these university sport programs that have been exposed, you know, in the last sort of 5-10 years as being absolutely toxic, like toxic to the point where the athlete dies. And it's become this kind of a loggerhead where kids are saying very clearly to us, we're not healthy. We suffer from extremely high levels of mental illness. Your approach to make us resilient and tough and have grit is really backfiring. We want to go and play video games because there's no adults in the room. We go and do skateboarding to the most remarkable athletic prowess and levels because every time we make a mistake, there's no one shaming us. Our brain learns by making mistakes. We fall, we get up, we try again until we become proficient at mind-bending athletic performance.
Wow. Yeah, I think you're so right. And it's sad because, you know, we always like to keep our episodes on a Smart Family Podcast kind of evergreen by not talking too much about current events. But sadly, stories about bullying in sports and toxic sports environments is an evergreen story. And so, you know, we've heard recently about some things going on in Hockey Canada and some of the culture there and how things really haven't changed in decades. And that's been, you know, there's been a spotlight shone on that over the last few weeks. You know, on the last Olympics, we saw the, you know, complete humiliation of an Olympic figure skater that was, you know, bullied on the sidelines by her coach. And I can go on. I mean, there's all these stories out there. But my question for you, Jennifer, is does sports have to be that way? Like, does it, I mean, is this required to produce high-level athletes? Is that sort of the thinking that's out there?
Well, you know, you just nailed it perfectly, Rob, because so again, let's go back to me as the researcher. I said to myself, well, you know, there seems to be this pervasive belief that if you don't abuse athletes, then they won't achieve greatness. So I'm like, okay, well, let's find all the sports psychology research on that. Let's find out what the doctors say and the psychiatrists and the neuroscientists, because there's got to be a really big stack of research or we wouldn't be doing such foolish things. Well, I can tell you, there is not one single piece of research, not one, that says if you don't abuse an athlete, they won't achieve greatness. And so, as you know, from reading my book, I made a whole chapter about that. And I really unpacked our mindset. And, you know, it's what Dr. Michael Merzenich, the neuroscientist, would call a false bill of goods. We've been sold a false bill of goods. There is nothing that shows that humiliating, shaming, hurting, driving to the point of exhaustion or overheating or any of these things, none of these things create great athletes. All they do is damage bodies and really damage brains. So in my book, I very specifically wrote that chapter about a jazz band, because a lot of sport people believe, and they say to me repeatedly, they're like, oh, you don't really understand how tough it is out there. And, you know, what we have to do to get performance. And we have to do it this way, or we won't, you know, we have to win. Winning is the name of the game in sports, and you just don't understand it. So what I do in that particular chapter is show, if it's so true in sports, why are we seeing identical toxic masculinity models, bullying and abuse in jazz band? And because they are identical, literally gesture by gesture, word by word. And, you know, for parents, I think one of the best things we can do is not fall for this kind of mythology. We have to debunk it and we have to look at what's factual. And I'll give you two facts. Mm-hmm. Fact number one is Jordan McNair was a football player He was on the University of Maryland team. He must have been brilliant to get there in the first place. He was working his heart out. He was trying his hardest. He was with his team. But unfortunately, they were coached and trained by people who believed in homophobic slurs and humiliation and yelling in the face and toxic masculinity. And so Jordan McNair, when his body was screaming at him and his brain was screaming at him that he was overheating, he couldn't listen to those messages that were literally like making his legs buckle, making him fall to the ground, making him convulse. And his coaches, of course, interpreted this as, you know, not trying hard enough, laziness, you're not putting in full effort. They didn't get him the medical help he needed. And he died 2 weeks later of heat exhaustion, and he was 19 years old.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. That's fact number one. Let's put fact number two beside that. There is an athlete who daily does really sort of high level training that has a lot to do with stretching and tension, because his trainer knows that this is the way to get optimum football performance without injury. It's a really good way to avoid damaging the body. Mm-hmm. And this football player also does daily brain training. He does Michael Merzenich's Brain HQ program every single day, and it's built into his regime because he knows that you have to have a high-performing brain to do well in football. This football player doesn't have a single individual who would dream of humiliating him, using homophobic slurs, putting him down, yelling in his face, or berating or shaming or ignoring him. Mm-hmm. And this football player actually is 44, and he outperforms 22-year-olds at the sport. He's considered one of the world's greatest quarterback, and this would be Tom Brady. So I say to parents, choose who you want your kid to be. You lose your kid at 19, Jordan McNair, because he's been trapped in this toxic masculinity world, or you have Tom Brady. You can give your kid each chance, but it's really important that you're knowledgeable about what the research says.
You're right. Wow. Those are two incredible examples. And it just does sort of challenge this concept of, you know, coaches feeling like they need to create this sort of adversarial environment, you know, where, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, no pain, no gain. I mean, these are such, you know, timeless messages that we hear being thrown at players to kind of motivate them to perform harder and to excel, and for coaches to really get their players to kind of stretch beyond their comfort zone. But you're saying that that's actually even counterproductive in your first example, you know, is the ultimate example of that. And that maybe we should be looking at a whole different paradigm.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's so funny how people just kind of repeat these broken phrases in a broken system. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the things that I looked at was Phil Jackson, for example. So I chose Phil Jackson, the basketball coach, because I was like, how come he's so high achieving? How come he has repeat unbelievable NBA success? You know, what is it about him? And, you know, he's an employee, a trainer that screams, in the face of his players, and, you know, yells obscenities from the sidelines when these athletes are trying to perform. I mean, there's no other place in the world where, you know, you've got a high performing CEO, you'd have somebody standing over him screaming obscenities at him. I mean, the guy couldn't concentrate. Like, it's just kind of, as you say, Rob, it's like a no brainer. So why we somehow believe this myth in sports, I don't know. So I took a look at Phil Jackson, and Phil Jackson actually employs did back in the day when he had the late Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan, he employed a mindfulness coach. And George Mumford trained these athletes how to go into flow. And they would play at the highest level with 60,000 people screaming, but they don't even hear them because their whole construct is grounded in being in the moment, being in the sport, being with their players, the team, flowing in the game, seeing their opponents from almost a bird's eye view because they were so deeply empathically in the moment. And they learned it through mindfulness training, not by, you know, someone yelling at them. So I really think, you know, all of us, like, and mindfulness, as you would know, is one of the best things for the brain. It's heavily documented in neuroscience that if we want our kids to be healthy and resilient and clear-headed and high-performing, whether it's in academics or sports or arts or just in their personal life, one of the best things they can do is play sports. Of their choice. It could be yoga. It can be martial arts. It can be soccer, football, or, you know, of course, we have to be careful about concussion, but it can be cycling like you do. It can be anything that gets, you know, oxygenated blood pumped up into the brain. And then plus the combination of like sports strategy, having to use your intellectual brain and your social emotional brain simultaneously at high levels of fitness, that is like a beautiful thing for the human brain. It really flourishes in that environment because it loves learning and it loves performance. But you know, we tend to start to limit kids' sports as they get older. We don't say, hey, why don't you try rowing? Maybe you would love, you know, skiing. We start to say, oh, you're showing, you know, shine at soccer. Well, that's the only sport you can play. And we're going to drive you so hard in it that you start to lose a sense of selfhood and you start to get overuse injuries. Like it's an adult issue that we just have to tackle. I think we can make such positive change.
Awesome. So you're still a proponent of putting kids into sports?
I think sports, except for the concussion piece, which I think we need to, you know, absolutely be, you know, completely safety first when it comes to head injuries. But other than concussion, I think sports is one of the greatest things for kids. Yeah. I mean, one of the most important things for the adolescent brain, and you know, that's a well-known tough time. We all survive it. But I mean, the stats on adolescents are you're four times more likely to die during that period of your life. And so there are most sensitized brains, there are most at-risk brains and bodies, and you know, they need a lot of care and a lot of scaffolding and structure around them to keep them safe. And so the best way to work with an adolescent brain is repetition and training. And the sport model where you daily work at improving skills is a really great way to teach kids about, hey, you want to learn the skill of being more articulate or communicating more effectively with your peers or having more confidence or more compassion. Those are skills. And we can do daily training to enhance them in you.
Yeah. I think the message that you just mentioned there about how kids actually need to use their brains, not just for mindfulness and kind of getting into zone, but also just to kind of work on sports strategy, to kind of keep the plays in mind. I mean, it takes a lot of mental energy to do a sport well. And I talk to parents all the time about how, you know, when you're anxious or when you're stressed, you know, your brain really essentially shuts down to learning. Like you are just in fight, flight, survival mode. Your brain's not open for business, for learning new things. And here we are, you know, trying to use coaching techniques, which kind of put kids in fight, flight, or even like shutdown, and then expect them to learn new things. Well, I could see that would be impossible. So, I mean, you're kind of taking that educational understanding to the, you know, to the court or to the field in the exact same analogy.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that parents can watch out for is exactly that manifestation in their child. I mean, it's really important to understand that the stress hormone cortisol, if your child is going into an athletic situation where they're being peer bullied or they're being bullied by the coaches, their cortisol will start pumping up before the practice and before the game. And then after they come home and they go into their room and they shut their door and they don't want to talk, the cortisol is pumping and pumping. And this stress hormone, it's natural and healthy and was designed by the brain, as you were saying, for fight, flight, and freeze to protect us from a predator. And that's what it feels like when you've got a bullying peer or a bullying coach or a bullying anybody, your brain interprets that as an extreme threat. And so it pumps up adrenaline and cortisol, and it's really hard for the cortisol to dissipate in our modern world because there are way too many stresses on our young people and on adults. And so it's really like parents need to watch for the red flags of a child who used to be passionate about a sport saying, they'll try out phrases like my son did. My son came home at 16 and said, those guys are freaks. But I didn't put two and two together. If he'd come home and said to me, you know what? the coaches are verbally and physically abusive. I can feel my cortisol levels going through the roof. I can't concentrate anymore. I can barely hear what they're saying. I'm so traumatized. I'm developing learned helplessness and a perception of inescapability, you know, just like a domestic abuse, you know, victim where I feel like I can't get out of the situation. I love my sport so much, but I feel like they're taking my passion away and I don't know what to do or how to protect myself. What do you think I should do, mom and dad? Mm-hmm. We don't teach our kids that vocabulary. They have no idea that adults are abusive because we don't tell them.
Yeah. So before I want to zoom out a little bit to kind of the general, you know, power dynamics and bullying and what we can do about that. But just kind of when it comes to sports, have you seen, Jennifer, any sports organizations that actually do this well, that have addressed this topic, where, you know, we may have some parents listening right now who are like, oh gosh, like, should I even put my kids in sports? Okay, well, yes, but, you know, what sports are maybe better suited for this? And you know, my child, like every child is sensitive to being bullied and criticized. Are there any sports that you have seen that actually do this well and that really tackled this in a positive way?
Oh my goodness. I wish you hadn't asked me that because I want to go back and say there are amazing coaches out there without a doubt. There are so many dedicated, emotional, social, intelligent, informed. They know the science. They know the psychology. There are amazing coaches out there. So it's not a sport specific. Okay. And it is a minority of coaches who are abusive. It's just that it works like a virus. So, you know, we say to ourselves, we have an epidemic of bullying in child populations. And we say things or we know things. This has been a recent statistic that's been discussed, and it's a painful one, but I'm going to say it. We now know that youth suicide, so that's 10-year-olds to 24-year-olds, from 2000 to 2018, suicide has increased 57%. Mm-hmm. So the virus of bullying and abuse, I would argue, is very, very serious. It's infectious, it's cyclical, and it's out of control. So we really need to work together across all sports to get rehabilitation of some kind, or certainly block individuals who do not or they struggle to stop themselves from very compulsive behaviors around bullying and abuse in whatever form it is, emotional, sexual, or physical. But, you know, I'm on a task force for gymnastics in Canada, and it has been an incredible uphill battle to get it recognized that the sport is described as a culture of cruelty. There has been 9 investigations across the world, and it's rampant across the world, this cruelty. And, you know, and you compare it to football, these little girls, I mean, they just, you would not believe the things they do to them. And it's been really hard to make change. Now there has been a shift recently, what with bobsled Canada and gymnastics Canada and sport Canada, I mean, sorry, soccer Canada. And then the hockey situation, it seems like our government is really listening, and our sport minister is really understanding we need urgent action, and we need to address this. But I would say to parents that, you know, parents get a bad rap for being so-called helicopter parents. And I've been trying to think of a different way to reframe that. And I think parents should be not trying to experience things for their children and not trying to intervene in their children's you know, direct interactions with others and so on, but they should be drone parents. They should be very sure at all times what's going on in their child's practices and kids. So you should never really have your child at practices without being there. Okay. And you shouldn't fall for the, oh, parents are so distracting, these are closed door practices. Any of those things are red flags that whatever's going on, they don't want you to see it. And another really important thing for parents to learn, and this is a tough one, our brains do not respond well to this because they're, you know, as you know, they're sequential processors. So they cannot understand that somebody is a Dr. Jekyll that they see and treats them as a respected adult, and they're cordial and they're charismatic and they're intelligent. And that's Dr. Jekyll. And they can't, it's so hard for our brains to understand that when they do the closed door practice, they become Mr. Hyde. a completely different character when they are in power. And it goes back to what you were saying before about power dynamics. It seems like we have certain people who, and you know, this is, it's complex, but in the literature, it's very clear a correlation, not for all people, but the majority, that if they are highly abusive, it's because they were once victims. They are now identifying with the aggressor and they're acting out the drama of their own trauma over and over and over again. It does not help them get better.
Right. And we say that not to excuse that behavior, but simply to explain that.
Yes.
And I also want to just highlight too that indeed there are so many excellent coaches out there who actually do get this and who do care about the emotional well-being of their athletes. And I've been fortunate to have my kids involved in sports and to have had excellent coaches. So we do want to be careful not to paint all coaches and sports with the same brush. I guess want to highlight that as well.
I completely agree. And you know, coaches and teachers, you know, starting in grade, you know, kindergarten, grade one, our kids spend more time with them than they do with us. Mm-hmm. And those people, I mean, they have to be supported and given the very best education and given opportunities to change when they need it, opportunities to deepen their learning or to heal their own suffering because they're so influential. They should be, you know, given every opportunity to become knowledgeable and healthy and well so that they can do their jobs to the best of their ability. That's, they're just so important.
Yeah. So can we zoom out a little bit here? Because, you know, your book is about much more than sports. And in fact, I think you take, great strides in making sure that we're not just talking about sports because it exists in other areas as well. And in areas where there is, you know, a power dynamic that's going on can be one that is prone to having a bullying relationship. So can you just maybe define what you mean by bullying? Because it doesn't sound like it's simply the kid in the schoolyard who steals your lunch money. What you mean by bullying? And then I'd love for you to explain, like, what happens to the brain when it's subjected to bullying?
Well, when I talk about bullying, I mean everything from microaggressions all the way up to some of what we would consider in society to be the most damaging forms, like total violation of the body, for example.
Yeah.
And a microaggression, sometimes people aren't familiar with that term. A microaggression is, you know, when you make a joke and you offend people and then you say, oh, I was just kidding. Or put someone down and you humiliate them and say, oh, I was just teasing. Or you don't invite somebody to something and say it was an accident, or you ghost them on email, you don't reply and it hurts their feelings and you say you're just too busy, whatever. Microaggressions are in that, you know, someone asks you a question and you act as though they didn't speak, all these little sort of hurtful things.
Yeah.
And the reason why microaggressions are dangerous in the research is because they create the conditions for us to be laissez-faire about bullying that's more abusive and more damaging and is escalating. It's harder to see it when you're in a culture that sort of sweeps under the rug all kinds of meannesses and small cruelties. So when I talk about bullying, I never talk about children. And it's very purposeful. I don't look at children who bully other children. My view of that is that's an urgent sign that the child is at a tipping point into mental illness. It's a sign that there's something very, very wrong in their lives. And it's incumbent upon the adults in their world to figure that out and get them help. And get their family help if they need it, which they probably do. Bullying is a really big red flag that a child does not need discipline. They don't need to be told they're being bad and be punished in some way. They need help. And that is really important. But what I focus on is bullying in adult populations because children are born wired for empathy. We know that the human brain is an incredibly empathic organ from the day the child comes into the world. So my question is, if bullying is learned behavior, we have to find the courage to look at how we teach it. How do we teach our children to become bullies when in actual fact, they had this golden potential to be remarkably empathic? And that those neural networks, those pathways in the brain are being damaged by adult behaviors. So one of the things that I try to get adults to do to understand adult bullying and why it's so confusing and causes so much sort of unhealthy brain reaction in children is to say, you know, we tell children, don't be a bully. Bullying is bad. These are the behaviors. We have zero tolerance for it. In fact, we're writing more and more stringent laws about you children who are bullying. Mm-hmm. And then you turn on the TV or you go onto the internet and you can watch politicians in the most prestigious, powerful positions in our world demonstrate blatant bullying behaviors with zero accountability. Mm-hmm. How is a child, a teenager, a young person supposed to understand this? Well, really what happens is from a very early age, we'll see a child who is using bullying behaviors because they are striving for that kind of status and power and prestige among their peers. It's a natural brain reaction. So adults have got to figure out, is bullying okay or is bullying not okay? If it's not okay, then we can teach that to children, and we have to be very sure we never role model it to children. Because if adults want kids to be empathic and compassionate and self-aware, then we have to demonstrate it. Kids learn by watching us. They don't learn by what we say. They learn by what we do. So that is, you know, in a sort of writ large overarching sense, this is my approach to bullying.
Okay.
But, yeah.
So then tell us then how a child who's bullied by an adult or someone who is in power over them, you know, what does that actually do to their brain? You mentioned cortisol earlier already as being sort of this toxic substance for the brain. I mean, it's great for the short term. It gets you out of a dangerous situation, but long-term exposure to cortisol is very damaging to all parts of the body. What happens when kids are bullied?
Well, I want to go back to something that you said before. So if we talk about, you said, you know, the brain, let's say kids gone into a classroom or the child is learning from their parents or they go to a sports practice. And really the brain is primed for creativity and learning and making mistakes because that's how the brain learns. And it's completely on fire to absorb information and acquire skills. That's what our brains are designed for. And the more we do that, happier our brains are. But if you go into a bullying abuse situation, your brain goes into the sympathetic response system, the cortisol gets activated, and all of those other things get sidelined because the brain prioritizes survival and it thinks it's under threat. So cortisol in that moment, for example, would be attacking the hippocampus. So that's the part of the brain, if we can isolate out parts. It works as an organic whole, but for the sake of this, let's talk about the hippocampus as involved in memory and memory sorting and in learning. And if it's getting bathed in cortisol, it's starting to shrink and shrivel. And this can be seen on a brain scan. So the neuroscientists have been looking at all these different ways in which the brain is damaged. So to give you another example, if you study the brains of murderers in prison, and this has been studied and done, you'll find that oftentimes they have an enlarged or sort of swollen amygdala in their brain. Yep. And that it's likely, well, you would know all this, Rob, of course, but for the sake of people listening, it's hardly surprising. I mean, murderers don't usually grow up in safe, happy, healthy, educated homes. They grow up under extreme threat and they become highly aggressive because that's the only way they survive. And they're deeply, deeply traumatized. Well, it makes sense then when you look at their brain on a brain scan that the threat response system, the part of the brain that is seeking like a kind of a watchtower for anything that might attack, is enlarged. It's getting lots of brain energy because that's how this person has survived. So it's, you know, and at the beginning of my book, I start with this statistic to get people to understand really what we have to do is shift from a society that has this outdated notion that bullying and abuse are a moral issue, because they're not. They're a big medical problem. They're a medical issue. And so when you look at 70% of prisoners in the California prison system, 70% of them were in foster care. Mm-hmm. Are those bad kids? Like, am I a good person? And Rob, are you a good person because we weren't in foster care? How does that work? You know, it's attaching a moral outcome to a medical problem.
You've kind of, you know, tapped into the trauma literature and you mentioned this in your book as well, the adverse childhood experiences literature. So that's the ACEs literature. that really identifies that toxic stress and trauma in childhood leads to physical and mental health problems, you know, later on in life, and not just like a few years after, but decades after, and probably is associated with many and of the chronic health problems that adults suffer from. And so you're right. This is a public health crisis, not a moral failure per se, but a real medical public health crisis.
And I'm really glad you brought that up, because I have a couple of aspects about the ACEs that I think have to be addressed. And one of them, and so for people that don't know this study, it was in the 1990s done by two American doctors. And it has some of the most important scientific and health issue knowledge and public policy knowledge that we have today. And yet it hasn't really made much difference in society, but it should. But the ACEs questionnaire, it was 10 questions, but they were all geared towards the home. They asked you if you were emotionally abused in your home or physically abused. Were you emotionally neglected in your home? But they didn't ask you if you were on the receiving end of that from a teacher or a coach or an arts instructor or someone at the church. And we don't even know the half of how widespread the child abuse issue is in our society, because the two American doctors who did this research were absolutely shocked and kind of heartbroken when they shared with their medical peers this knowledge. One of these doctors cried. He said he did not know how rampant child abuse is in our society. So this is an urgent issue. And what I think parents and all of us need to know is that we are a very visual creatures, and we can't see our brains, so we ignore them. And we can't see that our brains have injuries, so we don't heal them. We don't repair them. And there's amazing evidence-based ways that we can get our brains absolutely right back to our organic health if they have been abused.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, the ACEs questionnaire actually doesn't include the word bullying, although it does, of course, it is implied in many of the types of adverse experiences that are asked about on the questionnaire, but bullying is not on there. And neither are things like those microaggressions or racism or, homophobia, et cetera. I mean, those are all such toxic situations that people face, but surprisingly are not, and maybe because the ACEs questionnaire was meant to be a study tool to kind of uncover the problem. And we all recognize that there's many more adverse childhood experiences that children can face.
Yeah. And I mean, as you would know, when you're doing research like that, you have to keep a narrow focus in order for the research to be, you know, proper and accurate, and you have to control everything. So it was a very controlled experiment. But I mean, the ominous thing is, it just is such a warning sign of how much work we really need to do to get people knowledgeable. And I mean, I would love to see a brain curriculum in schools. You know, children should be learning as much about their brains as they learn about math. They should be learning as much about their brains as they learn about geography or, you know, social studies. The brain is the absolute cornerstone and foundation to everything. And then we can learn everything else along with it. But we have to teach kids and everyone else, catch the rest of us up, about brains and how to keep our brains healthy and injury free and safe.
And sadly enough, there's a lot of pushback against some concepts of social emotional learning in the classroom and how that should be part of the, you know, the four R's. You know, I talk about reading, writing and arithmetic, and then regulation. And of course that couples with mindfulness and things exactly like what you're talking about, but there's some real pushback against that for some reason. Not sure why.
I honestly do not understand that. I mean, what I hope parents have as a takeaway from our conversation is the brain is highly adept at repair. You can break a bone in the body, you can tear an ACL, and you can have extreme damage done to your brain. And it is a miracle how it can repair if you do the correct evidence-based practices to get it better. But, you know, we're a society that not very long ago, we thought a concussion was a badge of honor in sports. You know, you'd clap the kid on the back and tell him he got his bell rung and to get back out there and do it for the team. Yeah. You know, and the parents would be clapping hands. Well, we now know that athlete has just suffered a traumatic brain injury, and there are very clear protocols to make sure that the brain heals before it goes back into play. It's not a radical thing. It's actually a common sense thing. You know, like any part of the body, if you hurt the brain, you have to repair it. You need a cast on the arm. You need, you know, surgery perhaps on the ACL, and you need the brain to be doing the evidence-based practices that it needs to do to heal and recover.
So maybe let's wrap up with that, because one of the big concepts that you talk about a lot is neuroplasticity, which is this idea that the brain changes, it molds over time, especially during childhood, but really throughout our lifetime. I mean, there's this kind of outdated notion that, you know, the cement dries and it's impossible to have neuroplasticity when you're older. But you argue, and with the evidence, that, you know, brains do still learn and mold and adapt over time in really amazing ways. So, which also means that while brains can get damaged that way, they can also heal that way as well. And maybe wrap up with this concept of how we heal from bullying. Let's say we've had a child who's been exposed to bullying, or one of our kids is an athlete who's been in a toxic sports environment. How can they heal from that? How can they move forward from that and lead healthy, productive lives?
In the book, I really try to offer, you know, along with the very difficult material on how much bullying and abuse in all forms, how much it hurts the brain, I really focus on what does the research say about what could I do? Just myself. Mm-hmm. I'm a citizen. I'm not a neuroscientist. What can I do in my life to make my brain better? And so I unpacked a kind of system that, I mean, I developed a system for my own unique brain, because we all have different brains and we all respond to stress and to abuse and bullying and everything else in very different ways. Your brain is as unique as your fingerprints. And so I designed a program whereby I thought of it as you need to work on aligning your mind. So there's your mindfulness with your brain. That's not being brainless. You want to be brain full, right? Mm-hmm. So mindfulness, brainfulness, and then physical. The body fullness, you know, and when you get all those three things working together, as opposed to at cross purposes, you are unstoppable. And this is what we all want for our children. We want them to have happy, healthy, fulfilled, meaningful, high achieving lives. And really, if you align mind, brain, and body, and you look at the research for each of those three things and how to get them to communicate with one another in a really healthy, aware, informed way, as opposed to uninformed, it's incredible what you can do. So, you know, we can come full circle here to sports, because one of the fascinating things about our bodies is that we can use our bodies to really amp up our brain health and brain performance. So for example, let's go back to the cortisol. When you are doing aerobic exercise, you are not only like pumping oxygenated blood through your body, but also into your brain. And your brain really is able to reduce high stress levels by that. And it pumps up BDNF, mm-hmm. and which, let's just use the short form for it. Nobody needs to know what that stands for. But if we know that cortisol is a really corrosive thing when it's left, you know, bathing the brain in all this stress hormone, BDNF is like a fertilizer. It's something that really makes the brain healthy and resilient. It helps neurogenesis, for example, which is the birth of new brain cells. And yeah, I think going back to this concept of neuroplasticity, which is one of the most important, you want your brain to be growing and changing and becoming more refined and healthier as you age. You know, right until the last moment you're on the planet, you have the capacity to strengthen your brain, but you also have the capacity to make it weaker. And so knowing that and knowing what to do is really empowering. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, Jennifer, for maybe ending on that note. I think we've really learned a lot in this conversation about how bullying exists in sports, how that really should be a very outdated paradigm, because it is toxic and damaging and absolutely not necessary to produce high level, functional, healthy, and I mean that in every holistic way, athletes. And then yet, if we do have kids who have been exposed to that sort of toxicity, and that there is hope that they can heal from that and really from any form of bullying and trauma that occurs during their life, especially during those vulnerable years when they're teenagers. So let's hope this does encourage parents to sign their kids up for sports, to get exercise, you know, to really stretch themselves and to grow and learn in both physical and mentally. So thanks for that message. Jennifer, your book's called The Bullied Brains, Heal Your Scars and Restore Your Health. Where can they find that? And where can they link to other resources related to this topic?
My website is bulliedbrain.com. So just like the title of the book, bulliedbrain.com. And it's actually just in the process of sort of being transformed. So if you look at it this week, it could be quite different in once my web designer finishes his work in a week or so. So you might go back to it, but it's packed full of resources. So I do tons of articles. I write for Psychology Today. I've written other books. I do interviews all the time. And all of those are just on the website. If you want more information or anything like that, there's a page that tells you how you can buy the book. It's available everywhere, but you know, it's an Amazon.com kind of book if you want to grab it there. Yep. And I do lots of consulting work, coaching work, one-on-one, and I'm also teaching a course at The Haven, which is a center. It's an online course, but it's for professional and personal development. It's a fabulous place here in BC. But I'll be teaching that in the fall. And if people want to kind of get that coaching and get themselves up to speed on how to get their brains back to organic health, I'm really happy to help.
Great. Well, thanks, Jennifer. I know you're a teacher by training and you've taught me a lot today and your book is extremely helpful and educational. So thank you for sharing this message with us. And I'm so glad to have talked to you today.
Well, I just in my time with you here, Rob, I've learned a ton from you and will continue to do so. So thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Jennifer. Well, that was a treat. So great to talk to Jennifer. What a great journey in our conversation from talking about bullying in sports to bullying in society and what bullying is and what sports could look like if we changed the paradigm. I love those few examples he touched on, which highlighted coaches who took brain health seriously and coached in a social, emotionally intelligent way to really get the most out of their athletes. Also, the concept of how bullying in general literally damages the brain on a cellular and functional level, kind of like a psychological concussion, and certainly something we need to take very seriously. Just like we do physical concussions. I think we've seen enough about how damaging these toxic sports cultures can be and how our kids need exactly the opposite. So are you going to sign your kids up for sports? Are you going to get them into sports? I hope so. But find a team with a coach who can be a real role model for your child. Now, you'll never find a perfect coach and a perfect team, just like you'll never find a perfect parent and a perfect family. But look for the sports team, the coach, and the team that understands that brain health and mental health is just as important as physical health, where your kids are holistically nurtured. I know they are out there because I've seen my own kids really benefit from those experiences, and I count many of my own kids' coaches as being among the great role models in their lives. Well, thanks for joining us today. I hope you learned something. Check out Jennifer's book, The Bullied Brain, and her website, bulliedbrain.com, and get educated about neuroscience. It'll make you a better parent. And check out the Smart Family Podcast on Instagram. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts. Perhaps look up some episodes you missed in the past and share this episode with your friends. And join us next time on the Smart Family Podcast, where it is our aim to help you love being home.